there's this whole problem of who is going to go first in terms of making a big push for denuclearization.
The leaders of North and South Korea prepare to meet again. It's Tuesday, September 18th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Glad to have you with us. Join us as well on Facebook at VOA Asia. Coming up, the trade war is heating up. Australia to help secure upcoming APEC summit. The hazards of ship demolition. Lifelike robots and wooden cameras. It's all on today's VOA Asia. South Korean President Moon Jae-in is scheduled to arrive later Tuesday in Pyongyang for a three-day summit with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. This is their third this year. Special Presidential Advisor Moon Chung-in said the North's denuclearization will be a top priority.
Obviously, President Moon will be placing utmost importance on denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. Therefore, he will try to play a role of a facilitator or a mediator between Pyongyang and Washington. Okay? He strongly believes that when there is a stalemate between Pyongyang and Washington, he can play a role of narrowing the gap between Pyongyang and Washington and facilitate dialogue between the two countries.
Chief Presidential Secretary Im Jong-suk said while the South is trying to mediate further progress between the North and the United States following their June summit in Singapore, he also hopes for progress in easing Korean military tensions. Monday, the UN Security Council met at the request of Washington to discuss enforcement of existing international sanctions on Pyongyang. Friday, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo accused Russia of actively attempting to undermine the Council resolutions of the so-called 1718 Committee, which evaluates compliance with sanctions by attempting to change the language. Can universal sanctions compliance be realized? Harry Kazianis of the Center for the National Interest doesn't think so.
No, unfortunately not, that the whole idea of maximum pressure died. And it probably actually died the day Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un shook hands. When you have a visual like that, when you have, you know, the world press sort of going Google and Gaga over, you know, Donald Trump shaking this dictator's hand, that has a legitimizing impact. When you also bring in the fact that the United States has already placed $50 billion worth of tariffs on Chinese goods, and potentially it was about to tariff another $200 billion worth of Chinese goods, China really has no impetus to really participate anymore in the maximum pressure campaign. So if you combine those two things together, really the whole idea of maximum pressure is going to start to fade away in the background. And that actually could push Donald Trump to doing a lot more in North Korea in terms of being much more flexible. So I think there's actually a lot of changes that are going to happen on U.S. policy and really in the coming days and weeks ahead.
Regarding President Trump, one of his picks for the ambassadorship to South Korea, which did not go through, he withdrew the name, Victor Cha of the Center for Strategic International Studies, is now suggesting that the president should agree to separate talks for a formal peace on the Korean Peninsula from the issue of denuclearization.
Well, Victor Cha is a gentleman and a scholar, and he's one of the best in the world, and I've read his work on that front, and I think he's absolutely correct. I think what the United States needs to do, though, is to really offer North Koreans a little bit of incentive. There's this whole problem of who is going to go first in terms of making a big push for denuclearization. Is it North Korea maybe offering up a nuclear weapon or some sort of a listing of its nuclear weapons? Or is it the United States that goes first and offers some sort of peace declaration? What I say to do is the United States and South Korea should offer a peace declaration to North Korea. It could be signed at the UN General Assembly in the coming weeks in New York when the Assembly is about to gather. And I think that really would say to Kim Jong-un, look, we've done everything we can to make you feel secure that we're not going to invade you, that we're not going to invoke regime change, that we're not going to attack you in any way. And we've done everything possible to sort of make you feel that you can come into the international arena. But now the ball is in your court. You need to make a move to do something to denuclearize. And I think that would put a lot of pressure on Kim to make a substantial move. If after that, if after three meetings with Mike Pompeo at the UN, if after a summit with Donald Trump, if after a peace declaration, Kim still won't make any move to denuclearize, I think we know the game is up, and I think we know we have to move on and change our strategy. But I think it would put a lot of pressure on Kim to really make a big move.
Harry Kazianis predicted movement at this week's summit toward an inter-Korean peace declaration. As for denuclearization, he believes that while progress is possible, it remains a years-long give-and-take process. These are among some of the top Asia stories you'll find right now on VOANews.com. Moon and Kim prepare for third inter-Korean summit. Dozens missing in Philippines after landslide triggered by Mangkhut. Typhoon lashes southern China. Bangladesh opposition demands release of leader before national election. Why robots that look too human make some people uneasy. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on Facebook at VOA Asia. You'll also find them on our VOANews.com website. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. President Donald Trump has indicated new trade tariffs are imminent on Chinese imports.
Last year, we lost $375 billion in deficits, and we had, in my opinion, way over $500 billion in cash, and that's not including certain items that we won't even talk about. So when I lose that, we can't do that. We can't do that anymore. It should have been done many years ago. It should have been done by other presidents. And actually, it's a disgrace that it wasn't done. So China's now paying us billions of dollars in tariffs, and hopefully we'll be able to work something out.
Reports say Trump is considering 10% tariffs on $200 billion in Chinese imports. The duties would be on top of 25% tariffs on steel imports and 10% on aluminum, as well as 25% penalties on another $50 billion in Chinese goods. China has welcomed a U.S. offer of another round of trade talks, but quoting a senior Chinese official, the Wall Street Journal said China would not negotiate with a gun pointed to its head. Christine McDaniel is a senior research fellow at George Mason University's Mercatus Center, and she tells VOA, given that China exports about $500 billion a year to the U.S. market, such an announcement would represent almost half of China's total exports.
Despite really all, you know, economic logic and evidence that the U.S. will lose from a tariff war with China, this president really does believe the U.S. loses from trade and he must impose tariffs. And he gets away with that mostly, at least with respect to China, because of the intellectual property theft in China and state-owned enterprises and subsidies and, frankly, you know, many of China's non-market economy practices. And so there doesn't seem to be much room for negotiating here. You have a president who is determined to continue to impose tariffs, who does not seem to give his U.S. negotiating team, largely Secretary Mnuchin, to lead the talks much room. Whenever he does, there's often a tendency for the president to tweet something that may contradict or undermine what Secretary Mnuchin is trying to accomplish. So it's not really clear what the incentives for China really are, you know, in terms of coming back to the table. Remember that Mr. Liu was supposed to be coming to Washington in the near future for the next round of talks. And now, given this recent announcement, it's not clear that that meeting will take place.
Christine McDaniel also comments on reports the Beijing government may refuse to take part in the trade talks should President Trump go ahead and impose additional tariffs, as published by the Wall Street Journal, citing Chinese officials.
And that's not surprising. I mean, again, if there was a clear objective here, or if when the Chinese team did come to Washington and then they could negotiate knowing that, you know, what was agreed upon would take off from there, I think that would be somewhat different. But given the last couple of rounds of talks where Mr. Liu didn't even get to see President Trump, or that he thought he had an agreement with Secretary Mnuchin, only to be undermined by a presidential tweet days later, that does make it difficult to engage in talks. On the other hand, the United States has made it very clear that they want to see major changes in the Chinese economy away from these non-market economy practices, away from state-owned enterprises, away from subsidies, away from cyber theft and intellectual property theft. And there's really no signs that China has taken those calls to heart in a meaningful way. You know, if anything, the Communist Party, you know, President Xi just seems to be clamping down on its power over the economy. So it's not clear how this will move forward with President Trump's insistent on tariffs and then President Xi's apparent lack of willingness to change course.
Christine McDaniel said she does not believe tariffs alone are sufficient to change Chinese behavior. She said a better approach might be collective action among global trading powers like the United States, Japan, and the European Union, whereby they commit not to do business with state-owned enterprises or businesses that do business with them. Happening now in Asia, South Korean officials say denuclearization is the heavy issue on the table of the upcoming inter-Korean summit, but downplayed the chance that they could obtain major progress on the issue. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. Glad to have you with us today on VOA Asia. Thank you for joining us. Australian warships, aircraft, and Special Forces soldiers will help safeguard the security of world leaders at November's APEC summit in Papua New Guinea. It will be the first time a Pacific Island country has hosted the summit. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Defence officials have confirmed that elite Australian army units are in Papua New Guinea, amid concerns the impoverished nation's military is not adequately equipped to properly secure the APEC summit. World leaders, including US Vice President Mike Pence, Russia's President Vladimir Putin, and the Chinese Premier Xi Jinping, are all expected to attend the two-day gathering in November. There are fears that cruise ships that will provide temporary accommodation in PNG's notoriously dangerous capital, Port Moresby, could be vulnerable to attack by terrorists. Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison has confirmed his country's massive military effort to provide security at the APEC summit, but the final costs of the contribution have not been revealed.
As you can expect, with so many world leaders coming together, the security and other arrangements that need to be in place need significant support. Our support to Papua New Guinea in hosting APEC has been in the works now for 12, 18 months.
Australian police have also been training and equipping local law enforcement officers. Australian Navy patrols have undertaken drills with Papua New Guinean forces as part of Exercise Paradise. Royal Australian Navy Commander John Cowan was satisfied with the joint manoeuvres.
Can I say that the PNG Defence Force Maritime Element has shown itself to be a very, very capable organisation and certainly, I think, well prepared to meet the challenges ahead.
Papua New Guinea is a South Pacific nation that lies to the east of Indonesia. It's Australia's nearest neighbour. The Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation was set up in 1989. It has 21 members, working towards greater regional economic integration. It also addresses food security, as well as threats to regional stability. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Coming up, the dangerous job of taking ships apart. You're listening to VOA Asia.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
This news from VOA Asia, Thai police charged the founder and two members of the Future Forward Party that is opposed to military rule with violating a computer crime law, an offense that could result in a five-year jail sentence. Visit VOA Asia Facebook each day for top stories and great features to see and share. This is VOA Asia. VOA Asia continues. The Pakistani coastal town of Gadani on the outskirts of Karachi is one of the largest ship demolition yards in the world, and it's a very dangerous place to work. In November 2016, more than two dozen workers were killed when a decommissioned oil tanker caught fire. The report, produced in Pakistan for VOA's Urdu service and narrated by VOA's Behzad Hamdard, looks at the challenges workers face every day in Gadani.
When ships outlive their usefulness, they are brought to coastal yards, like this one in Gadani, where more than 100 ships are demolished each year for parts and raw materials.
The reason why only four places in the world can be used for dismantling ships is because not every coastal body of water is deep enough. Gadani waters meet those ship-breaking requirements.
It takes 30 to 40 days to dismantle a ship. Aside from the long hours, the work can be dangerous. Workers in the billion-dollar industry are often victims of accidents due to inadequate gear or training.
The entire work involves metal structures. Explosions can occur, as I am sure you have heard and seen in the news. Two or three people die here every month.
It is a very hard and difficult job. When we leave our homes in the morning, we always think about whether we will return or not.
A major accident here in November 2016 killed 26 workers and injured 60. Since then, workers say nothing has been done to improve working conditions.
The wealthy owners here have made this job even more dangerous because there are no safety measures being taken. However, we have no other option except continuing working here because we have to make both ends meet. We are poor. If we refuse to work in these conditions, they will throw us out.
But the shipyard's owner insists safety standards are monitored and all workers are properly trained. He adds that both the government and the business owners must be held accountable for worker safety.
Government must facilitate this. They are taking a good revenue from this industry. Secondly, our own shipbreaking association can also take responsibility. We too can take development measures. And honestly, it isn't that big of an issue.
Ship demolition is not only hazardous for workers, it is also becoming a challenge for sea life and people who live nearby. Debris is dumped in the ocean and airborne chemicals have caused respiratory problems. That's a continuing worry for residents and the 12,000 workers whose livelihood depends on the ship demolition yard. Behzad Hamdard, VOA News, Washington.
This news from VOA Asia. Dozens have rallied in central Yangon against the jailing of two Reuters journalists and against what they say is a shrinking space for free expression in Myanmar. The journalists did not request but were handed sensitive information by police and subsequently arrested and convicted. Follow this and more on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, researchers are working to create robots that can do all types of jobs, and now some scientists are trying to make androids, or robots that appear human. But androids can make some people feel uneasy. VOA's Elizabeth Lee explains this feeling or phenomenon known as the uncanny valley.
Robots come in all shapes and sizes. Some are cute and make people smile. Others look a little too human and make people uncomfortable, including researchers.
I know how they work. I know that they're just machines. But something about something that just looks like a person but doesn't quite move like a person is disturbing.
That growing feeling of unease as a robot looks too human is called the uncanny valley. Computer science and psychology professor Jonathan Gratch says there are many explanations behind the uncanny valley phenomenon. One is that it is biological. People instinctively recognize when something seems wrong.
In my research, I study emotion and how we use emotional cues to read each other's minds. And I think a lot of the issue for me is if we try to make something very realistic, then you start trying to read all this information into what it's portraying, and it's not the right information. And so it just communicate something is off, something is wrong with this interaction.
Another explanation is a robot that looks too human threatens what it means to be human.
Initially, humans were seen as, you know, the only intelligent entity. And now we know more and more that animals can do many of the things we do, build tools. We know machines are starting to become intelligent. We hold on to the fact we're emotional, but now these machines are starting to be emotional as well, which is perhaps a threat. So where does that leave people?
The environments that we've been designing for ourselves.
John Rabula is working on making this humanoid robot, Hermes, walk more like a person by being more coordinated and balanced. He says the robot's face is not necessary and is clearly cosmetic.
We really do think of these as research machines that we're ripping apart and putting back together and ripping apart and putting back together. And so it's very easy for us to leave off the cosmetic bits.
Hermes can be considered cute, but if he looked more human...
I don't know if I'd want to be in the lab with a very human-like robot looking at me all the time. We have lots of late nights in lab and yelling at the robot a little bit as it is. Oh, why aren't you working? And so I don't necessarily myself need that extra layer of weird.
People who design machines to work with humans do keep the uncanny valley in mind.
But unfortunately, today I cannot give...
As they think about creating the robot's look.
That's what Jamie said this morning.
Elizabeth Lee, VOA News, Los Angeles.
Going back to simpler times and simpler technology, a Russian artist is going back to the roots of photography, rejecting the digital trappings and the assembly line convenience that the modern age has. He's designing and creating wooden cameras the way they were built 100 years ago. Combining craftsmanship with the tried and true principles of old school photography, some consider his creations art forms in themselves. And as VOA's Julie Tabo reports, his wooden cameras and the unique photographs that he takes with him are attracting buyers from around the world.
Sergei Lebedev is an artist. He creates old-fashioned pinhole cameras out of wood, much like they were made long ago.
This is the simplest principle of cameras and the way in which photography began, the way the first cameras were born. Essentially, they were simple wooden boxes. So if we look inside these cameras, we will see that these are ordinary wooden boxes in which light does not penetrate. Light penetrates through a small hole made with a needle. This is all that is needed in order to get an image on the film.
But Lebedev's cameras are a bit more elaborate than simple wooden boxes. The former factory worker uses elements found in nature to create his one-of-a-kind pieces. He combs the shoreline looking for wood from fallen trees, especially those naturally worn and polished by surf.
These pieces of driftwood were lying by the sea. In this case, there is a part of the trunk and root. As you can see, they are already without a bark and have a pleasant surface. It is not processed, and this way my cameras come out unpolished. This is a very typical tree surface, naturally washed by the sea.
He uses other natural materials like stones and shells to decorate his cameras and uses his artful creations to capture timeless images of the world around him. Lebedev's work, which includes both the cameras themselves and the unusual photographs he creates, are on display at an exhibit in his native region of Kaliningrad. His cameras sell for about $150 each, but his photographs are priceless. Julie Tabo, VOA News.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. Find us online at iTunes and SoundCloud. You can download us as a podcast. Take VOA Asia wherever you go. And wherever you go, we'd love to hear what you've seen, what you've heard. You can email us at voaasia@voanews.com or just contact us on Facebook. VOA Asia Facebook is the place to go, where you can find the program streaming every day as well. We'd also like to hear from you on our website, voanews.com. We thank everyone who's listening on the radio, Radioactive at Temasek Polytechnic in Singapore. Thanks for tuning in today. And we thank our director, Tracy Carter, our engineer, Zainab Abdel-Rahman, Managing Editor Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team, Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, and Doug Bernard. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a wonderful day.